The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back as we head into hour two. This is a very special delight and going to be a very special hour given a very special man we have in studio with us. He is Arizona's official state historian. A few weeks back, we had Arizona's official state balladeer, a dear friend of yours, Dolan Ellis, called in. Welcome to the studio to Professor Marshall Trimble, author of 100,000 books on the history of the West and the history of Arizona. We have some mutual friends, Hugh Hallman among them, Steve Twist, some others, and they thought you and I should just meet. It would be a lot of fun. So we all got together for dinner, and boy, did we ever have a good time, Marshall. And I said, we got to get you on air with us. So well, it's a delight to have you.
Well, I'm here.
You have so many students in this town. One of our sales reps said, Marshall Trimble, he was my teacher at Scottsdale Community.
Yeah, I got to behave. I can't be an old man, dirty old man or anything.
It's really tough. We'll forgive you. You were Hugh Hallman's teacher in high school, too, weren't you?
Yeah, Coronado High.
Yeah.
And that's where I had Grace in class.
Oh, it was at Coronado as well.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you're well-known in Arizona, but it's the first time on this show, so I always ask first-time guests to give them their own little autobiography, how you grew up, where you grew up, and how you came to be Arizona's official state historian.
Yeah. Well, I was born in Tempe in 1939 on a farm, and lived for a while on a farm in Lehigh, and then my dad hired out for the railroad, so we moved to Ash Fork, Arizona, and that's where I grew up. I was a senior in high school when he finally moved away. But that school was so small that the driver's education class and the sex education class were taught in the same car. It was one of those really small high schools. I think there were 10 in my senior class, so I can always say I was in the top 10. But when I moved away my senior year, I cut the size of the class by 10%, graduating class.
But
there, and then I went to West Phoenix High School, lived in the cultural center of Maryvale for a few years, and then Phoenix College, and then joined the Marines. And probably because I was flunking out of Phoenix College. And then from there, went over to ASU. And while I was in the Marines, I got interested in the guitar and playing the guitar. And I found out it was a neat way to meet girls. Mm-hmm. And so being a small town boy, I was kind of shy, and this really helped. So I kind of got... I'm only remembered at ASU today as a guy that used to sing Johnny Cash songs.
What was your favorite?
I started teaching school then because I didn't know what else to do. The only educated people I ever knew were school teachers. And the rest were all either rock doodlers, miners, or railroaders. Yeah. And so I went to college because all my friends were going to college. So I went to college. Didn't know what else. I was only good at two things, P.E. and history.
Okay.
So I chose P.E. as a major and history as a minor.
Uh-huh.
And started teaching P.E. first in Mesa. And then I got a little old librarian turned me on to Western history. Mm-hmm. And also working as a cowboy in Montana for a while during my lost years. Mm-hmm. And so I got fascinated with Western history, I started teaching American history, but I was all my American history was Lewis and Clark and the OK Corral, and out the West. Mm-hmm. I'd never been back east. Mm-hmm. Going back east was to me it was New Mexico, and so I started teaching at Coronado High School, And they said I could have one class in Southwest history if I could get 35 kids to sign up. So about 350 kids wanted, it was a big school, and about that many kids wanted into the class. So they took me out of American history completely and gave me, wound up with 10 sections all total of Southwest history. And then Scottsdale Community College opened, and they needed an Arizona history teacher. And so they'd heard about Coronado, so they brought me over there and gave me an interview and gave me a job creating an Arizona history class. And so for the next 45 years, I taught Arizona history at Scottsdale Community College. And my students, I never had any plans to write a book. And my students just said, you got to write. These were adults mostly in the classes at Scottsdale. So they said, you got to write a book and tell your stories. And I said, I couldn't even write a good term paper. How am I going to write a book? But I did. And, wouldn't you know, Doubleday in New York published it.
That's what's interesting. You've got about 40 books to your name, I think,
yeah.
Don't you?
It's either an awful lot of books or a lot of awful books.
No. But that was kind of a point I wanted to raise with you, because a lot of college professors obviously write, and there's this whole publisher Paris notion to be, you know, you have to write. But most of their writing is not popular. It's very, you know, it's very academic,
yeah.
I should say, or at least very narrowly, in a very narrow interest.
Yeah.
That wasn't your writing. You wrote for broadly interested people.
That's the kind of student I had at Scottsdale Community College.
Okay.
These were doctors and lawyers and retired.
So you were writing for your students, not fellow faculty.
Well educated, and I was telling stories, and they loved the stories.
Yeah.
And I dwell a little bit on what was important, mm-hmm. but my point was, whether you remember any of this stuff or not, when you get out of this class, if you leave with a good feeling, you're going to pursue. You're going to like the topic, and you're going to go. And I found out, and I still get letters from kids, and they're 60, 65 years old.
Yeah.
And I hate to date myself, but some of them are in their 70s now, some of my students.
The historian who passed a couple years ago now, maybe David McCullough, he said, you can't teach what you don't love.
Yeah. He's right.
Yeah.
I was a big fan of his, and I read his books. And
he clearly loves what he writes, as you do what you right. So much of which focuses on, the West, the cowboy, Arizona. So what is it about the cowboy? I mean, it's an interesting – or cowboys in literature and in movies, Marshall Trimble. Even, you know, movies about the Southwest from, I don't know, John Wayne to the John Ford stuff, they're popular on the East Coast too. They're popular across the world. Is it about the cowboy? Is it something representative? Is America instantiated in the American cowboy?
The cowboy, and I speak broadly of that, because the cowboy itself was not a very glamorous job.
Right.
It was a lot of sweat and dirt and sleeping on the ground, and a lot of them were just pretty much dregs of society, I guess you could call them. They drank, they womanized. Mm-hmm. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, but they many of them were outlaws on the side. But there was a romantic thing about it, and it all started, I think, probably with Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West.
Okay,
that show in 1883, Cody rounded up guys, and he made a cowboy a romantic figure.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And not just America, but the world, especially England and Germany and countries like that. But even in Japan, you know, they fascinated by the idea of the cowboy. And I think it was the free spirit. It was the thought that they were their own boss.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you something that I used to tell my students. So those cowboys had a lot of responsibility, too. They were uneducated. but they were responsible for the for taking care of the boss's herd.
Let me hold that thought real quick as I take a commercial break and pick up on that if I can with you. Marshall Trimble is my guest. He's Arizona's official state historian. His website, marshalltrimble.com, Marshall two L's, marshalltrimble.com. Many of you may have been his students. If you aren't, you are now. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I'm Seth Leibson. We're playing some Arizona music for you. That's of course Linda Ronstadt, Arizona family, coming in with our guest Marshall Trimble, who is Arizona's official state historian. MarshallTrimble.com, his website. We're talking about the mystique and the myth of the cowboy and the reality of the cowboy as you were doing it, Mr. Trimble, Professor, and you were saying that the cowboy had a lot of responsibility. Yes, the community, yes. But the herd, and go ahead. Go right ahead with that thought.
Well, this herd, I'm talking about on the Long Trail, but also just around a ranch itself, because we call them hairy banknotes, cattle.
Okay.
And that's cash to a rancher.
Uh-huh. And a lot of it.
It's an investment, right. And you've got your job is to take care of it.
Yeah.
And there was an old saying among cowboys: "You ride for the brand."
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. That would be good. That would be good information for anybody today working for somebody. Mm-hmm. If you, I'm kind of old fashioned, maybe, but I hope not. But when you work for somebody and they pay you. Your loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
They're also paying for your loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how that was a code, one of the codes of the West, unwritten codes. Mm-hmm. Those codes you see with Gene Autry and Roy Rogers and the Lone Ranger,
mm-hmm.
and Hopalong, those were just stuff for the kids. But there really was a riding for the brand, a loyalty thing that you, you sometimes died, fighting for that brand with rustlers and sometimes war parties of Indians and things like
that. And it was an honorable death.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is there a particular – it's probably an unfair question, Marshall.
A stampede.
Or a stampede. Yeah, right.
The deadliest of all. Or fording a river, drowned in a river.
Oh. This may be an unfair question, but is there one or a few movies that you think – are the best in depicting that, or that are favorites of yours in the West? I'll just tell you off the top right now. Mine is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Now, I know it's not necessarily a cowboy movie. There's some of that.
That was a great movie, though.
But, yeah, I love the John Ford stuff.
Yeah.
But is there any particular movies that you think capture?
Well, John Wayne's Red River
is
a good example. And John Ford, when that was done by Howard Hawks.
Okay.
But when John Ford saw the movie, he said – and I won't use the language he used, but he said, I didn't think that SOB could act.
Right.
That's typical Ford, though.
Sure.
He was you never knew when he was Irish. You never knew if he was kidding you or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there was another good movie called the Culpeper Cattle Company.
Okay.
And Lonesome Dove might have been the best of all.
People rave about Lonesome Dove.
Oh, yeah.
And it's still to my deficit that I haven't seen it. Everyone says they are insane over the fact that I haven't seen it. Everyone thinks Lonesome Dove
is
amazing.
It was outstanding. Of course, it was a series, so you have to cram in a Western movie. You have to cram everything into an hour and 45 minutes or something. But this, they had, I think, 8 or 10 episodes.
Okay.
So you could really stretch it out. But that was more realistic. McMurtry was I met him once or twice.
Oh yeah.
And that was really he really nailed it.
Good. All right, thank you for that. Interesting how it became a pejorative too, in a sense, the word cowboy. Sometimes it has become a negative connotation. Politically they'll say America is like a cowboy as a way to criticize us, mm-hmm. or that kind of cowboy behavior, as if it's kind of an unrestrained or unregulated or unmannered or uncouth behavior. But that was never the notion of the cowboy, was it?
No.
That's a modern.
No, not with a strict rancher.
Yeah.
A rancher really ran a strict – some of them wouldn't even let them a cuss.
Right.
And there's no drinking out on the trail. They had strict rules about that. Do it when you're in
accidents
town.
Will happen, right? And, I mean, it's a lot of danger.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Somebody gets hurt, and but responsibility was the key thing for a cowboy. And when they got to town, sometimes they were, and you got to remember too, some of these guys were post Civil War,
yep.
And they had really been through mano a mano battle,
yep.
fight to the death.
Yep.
And had seen death,
yep.
And we have names like PTSD for it, and I got the wrong acronym, I think, but
no, that's it. Post-traumatic, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah, you bet.
And so, but we never had names for stuff like that then. You were just gun crazy or crazy or something. And we did have some crazy ones. John Wesley Hardin is an example of a guy that was just totally nuts and scary.
All right. I'm going to take advantage of your presence here and talk to you about some Arizona myths and realities.
Yeah.
And you tell me however you want how much myth and how much reality. And my producer, David, we call him Young David over
Hi.
Here. We baptized him by fire because I was telling him the story of the Mogollon Monster. And he was making fun of me, saying there's no such thing. So I had Dolan Ellis call in and explain to him about the Mogollon Monster. But we won't do that. High Jolly and Quartzite, right? Quartzite. Yep.
That was the Great Camel Experiment.
Yes, sir.
And it was it was Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, that he was the one that pushed that through. He was Secretary of War at the time,
yes, sir.
In the 1850s. But there were a lot of waterless areas, especially across the deserts of New Mexico, Arizona, and California before you get to the coast. And they were trying to. They didn't have the telegraph yet,
mm-hmm.
And they just had a weekly stagecoach and such, but they needed to communicate and they needed to carry goods, and they found that these camels could carry almost twice as much as a horse, got long legs, they could go fast, and. They did have terrible breath.
Let me pick up on that. I want to pick up on that.
Bad tippers.
Bad tippers. Let me take a quick commercial break. We'll pick up more on the Camel Corps when we come right back with more from Marshall Trimble. Okay, welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. We need the Tuba City Truck Stop song, David. That's the song we need. That's the one that made Dolan famous internationally. Marshall Trimble is our guest. He is Arizona's official state historian, marshalltrimble.com. High Jolly, so that we have the statue. It's from a Camel Corps. That was the concept of Jefferson Davis.
Jefferson Davis.
And is it true, High Jolly, as we know him now, it was really named after a guy from Turkey whose name was Haji Ali or something.
Haji
Arabic,
Ali,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah.
And they corrupted that Haji Ali into
He had become a Muslim.
Uh-huh.
He had a Greek father and a Muslim mother.
Okay.
And I think he's... It was George something.
Okay.
I forgot his.
Okay. Hi,
he later took his other name back, his Anglo-type name back. But.
Something I was talking about with some friends the other day, Marshall, speaking of, an Arabic or a Muslim person here in Arizona, a lot of us that grew up here didn't witness and see a lot. I mean, there was some, but this was a state that didn't really have the race problems that other states had. Unless my memory is wrong, we didn't have a lot of the kind of bitterness over race here. It seemed like Arizona didn't care about that stuff. Am I wrong or misremembering that?
Well,
is that too much? Is that too romantic?
Seth, it was the Mexican. It was the gringo versus the Mexicano.
Okay.
And there was a lot of prejudice. However, before so many, I hate to say this, probably going to be a hate mail for it, but until the white women began moving out, because when in the earliest days, there were no white women to speak of in Arizona, very few.
Right, sure.
And so those Mexican girls, starting with the Santa Fe Trail,
okay,
coming into Santa Fe. Those Mexican girls were just beautiful.
Yeah, sure.
Those young girls, and they wore those sexy blouses,
sure,
those low cut blouses,
sure,
and short skirts,
mm-hmm,
for that time, short,
yeah,
skirts.
Yeah.
And when the boys came out from Missouri,
yeah,
and they were used to dresses that drug the ground and girls that wore clothes up to their neck and had a high morality because of the religion.
Sure.
And they came out here, and these girls were fun.
Uh-huh.
They danced and they sang, and it was a different culture. And these American boys that came out there, many of them remained in New Mexico.
Yeah, I gotcha. So the women,
and that carried over into Arizona.
Yeah, okay.
And so, and like the Ronstadts, they, uh-huh, they were German,
uh-huh,
German and Mexican.
Yeah,
and that was not uncommon at all.
Okay,
back then, before the, it was really the railroads that started bringing more women out.
Sure.
Up to that time, it was a small number.
Okay.
But so they married. It was not unusual to marry, and there were a lot of Jewish merchants who came out. Mm-hmm. Places like Tucson.
Yeah,
those names are just familiar today.
Yeah, I remember the Capon
Levy's
family,
and
the Capons,
like
and
that,
the Corricks.
And
yeah,
and they so that it was
Goldwasser, right?
Yeah, Goldwater. Yeah, and it was kind of it was a prejudice that came on much more later.
Okay.
And then the Mexican War did have a little, you know, but the prejudice wasn't like maybe say Texas.
Yeah, I was going to say it didn't metastasize, and the segregation was awfully different.
Yeah.
I remember a family from New York that I asked why they moved out here from New York, how they chose Arizona. This would have been in the 1950s. Said, well, we needed sun, we needed warmth, so we looked at Florida, and when we got there, we saw the segregated fountains and bathrooms and restaurants, and we just couldn't be part of that. And we looked at Arizona, and they just didn't have it. Just wasn't that kind of stuff,
yeah,
wasn't around in Arizona.
Yeah.
That's fascinating to me. Let me take a quick commercial break. Can I ask you,
yeah,
about the Lost Dutchman,
sure,
Lost,
mm-hmm,
Dutchman mine,
mm-hmm,
and,
yeah,
the OK Corral?
Sure, sure.
And Winston Churchill's American Blood?
Yeah.
The Jeromes?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Marshall Trimble is my guest. He and I'll be right back.
As requested.
Yeah, that's the Dolan Ellis song. Marshall Trimble is my guest. He's Arizona's official state historian. His website, marshalltrimble.com, author of 40 books or more, all of them great. You can read about them, you can get them, you can order them through his website or Amazon. Marshall, just running through some of the bigger legends in Arizona, or whether they're not, perhaps they're not legends, I asked people what they wanted you to talk about, what they liked, they thought they would like to hear about the Lost Dutchman.
It's a great story. I love it. I was one of those Dutchman hunters. In fact, it's too long a story to tell on the radio, but I own half of the Lost Dutchman mine.
Oh, do you?
Because I picked up a hitchhiker one time up on the Apache Trail.
Yes, sir.
And I gave him some beer.
Yeah.
I was researching something else I was working on, and a guy was thumbing a ride, and he claimed he had the Dutchman mine.
Okay.
And he was even in the newspapers, because back then all you had to do was say, I found the Lost Dutchman's mine, and the Arizona Republic would have a front page story on you. Can't get away with that today. But and he just said, because I shared my beer and I gave him a ride to Tortilla Flat,
uh-huh,
his parting words were, I'm going to give you half a share, half of my mine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm still waiting for it.
Yeah.
But, if anybody ever finds it, it's half mine.
Okay. You're laying a claim on radio. I think that's, yeah, considered notice.
But it's a great story.
Yeah.
You know, and because those mountains are majestic. I've wandered in and out of there ever since the 1960s. And I lived in Lehigh near, and so we used to go out there on the weekends in the 1940s. So I saw it way back as a kid. But the story, it's a great story, but it's got a lot of holes in it, shall we say?
Okay.
Like most lost treasure stories,
yeah. Yeah.
They grow with a telling, and everybody dreams. And I was We called ourselves Coronado's Children.
Yeah, Coronado.
They dream of striking it rich in one. And Arizona has more lost mines than any other, maybe all the other states put together.
No kidding.
Well, look at the country. Yeah. It's just wild country. Yeah. Look out in western Arizona, Quartzsite, north, and up in those mountains and the Weaver Mountains and and the Superstition and the Chiricahuas. They're ripe for having rich treasures. And I just had a letter a couple of days ago from a guy that found a rich Jesuit treasure in Sonora.
Oh, is that right?
He says.
Okay. You going to check it out?
I told him, I said, you better, whatever you do, don't mess with the Mexican government.
Okay. All right. You have
Those jails are not, Sonora jails are not fun.
They don't exactly abide by the Bill of Rights. Marshall Trimble, how much of the OK Corral is myth?
Not a whole lot of it.
Most of what we know is true.
It was. I've written probably more about that than anything else I've written about. Sure. And it was there was really an outlaw element there that it was not just a gang like the movies, but it was an element of maybe 100, maybe 200 of they were refugees from the Lincoln County War and the feuds in Texas, and they drifted out here because the law was less enforced out here than it was in the more settled areas like New Mexico and Texas. Mm-hmm. And these guys were, and the Mexican border was close. They were going down across the border and stealing from ranches cattle down there and bringing them up here and selling them in these mining camps. Mm-hmm. And these butcher shops and these, well, you know, people, those miners had to have their beef. Mm-hmm. And so they bought, Ike Clanton of one side there, he once said, I had a heck of a profit on cows because I didn't have to pay to buy. I didn't have to buy them. I mean, the profit was pure profit. And they just boasted about it. And there was another element, and this was more the business element, and this is really what it boiled down to, plus Republicans and Democrats, mm-hmm. and that they were trying to promote Eastern and California, San Francisco money into Arizona in the mines. And you don't hear that much. They don't stress that much in the movies. But this place was getting a bad reputation, a bad name. Yeah. And the Mexican government was protesting to the American government, the president, do something about this this outlawry, punish these outlaws, and you can't use the army because of the Posse Comitatus law, and so you can't do that. So in this case with Cochise County, they had a sheriff who was friendly mm-hmm. with the. He was from the same political party. Mm-hmm. I might add, the Cowboys were Democrats, mm-hmm. of course. Well, they were
sure.
Southerners.
Sure, they came from
And the Northerners were mostly the people that enforced the law, like the Wyatt or the Earp brothers.
Were the Earp brothers good people?
I liked them. Yeah, okay. I think they've been criticized mm-hmm. by people who they got too much attention, I guess. But they had a moral code, mm-hmm. and the other thing that people forget. These were gamers. Mm-hmm. They were gamers. They were sporting men. Yep. And a sporting man is going to take up with a prostitute. Mm-hmm. They're going to gamble. Mm-hmm. And they're going to play loosely with other people's money. Mm-hmm. But and Bat Masterson, yep. great lawman, yep. and written about him quite a bit. And he's well-respected as lawmen. Yeah. And... But they were also sporting men, and wherever the action was, see that's the key thing. Yeah. Wherever the action was, these guys were there. Dodge City, yep. Wherever. Then before that, it was Comstock, Virginia City, yep. Nevada. Mm-hmm. These guys were up there. There was money on the table. They were gamblers.
Yeah,
and you could these guys come into town from the mines. They got a pocket full of money, and no place to spend it, and they want to get on the gambling tables, and And you're just there. You're just waiting for another sucker to show up.
I love it. So
that's what they. I can't criticize that because that's. It was a respected gambling was a respected profession.
Yeah. Well, I'm not willing to say otherwise myself. Marshall Trimble and I'll be right back.
I worked in Vegas for a while.
You did? Did you?
I saw it all firsthand when I was a performer.
Be right back with Marshall Trimble. Welcome back. That's Wayne Newton as a young boy. Marshall Trimble has been my guest. He moves young, and we only began to scratch the surface of everything he can do with and for us. So I'm hoping this will be a down payment, sir, and you'll come back. This has been a great hour. I love listening to you, and I have...
Take me to dinner again.
We'll do a dinner, and we'll bring you right back. That's the price. If you come here, I'll pay it. Marshall Trimble, Arizona's official state historian. We didn't really touch on your music, and you said you used to play and still play, but you played a lot of guitar. You covered a lot of Johnny Cash songs, huh?
Oh, yeah. My mother was born in Arkansas in a little town across just about 20 miles from Dyess, Arkansas, where Johnny Cash was born.
Oh, okay.
A little older than him, maybe 10 years older than him. But there was something about him. I remember when I was 16 years old, Johnny Cash was just starting, and he played at a little joint here in Phoenix right on Central Avenue. And I went, and he had the look.
Yeah.
Elvis had the look. Yep. A lot of these guys had the look.
You just have it or you don't. And they did.
Yeah. And when I was in boot camp in the Marines, there was a guy from Tupelo, Mississippi.
Yeah.
And he sang Johnny Cash songs, and he sounded just like Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
And I thought, when I get out of this outfit, I'm going to play the guitar. So I came back. When I got back to Arizona, first thing I did was I bought a guitar for $5, yes, a Gibson, a used Gibson. It would cost hundreds of dollars now, but yeah. I bought it, and I taught myself to play, and I'd listen to Johnny Cash records. And then when I got to college at ASU, I did Johnny Cash songs, How High is the Water, Mama.
Yeah. And 5 feet high and rising.
5 foot high and rising.
Yes, sir.
And I love those songs.
Yeah.
And Rock and Roll Ruby was one. I don't know if he ever recorded it or not, but he wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to get up there and do an Elvis impression with Rock and Roll Ruby, and it just. But then when my book, I got into a folk group. We were one of these folk groups called ourselves the Jenny Mill Three, and we recorded four records, I guess it was, for audio recorders here in the valley, but. It never went anywhere. The jukeboxes in Springerville had them. That was about it. But anyway, I played the bars of Scottsdale and here in the Phoenix area. I didn't do the folk houses.
Mm-hmm.
They were too serious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it.
The money was much better in the bars.
Yeah, I bet.
And I was a broke, poor broke kid. So I did that, and then after I wrote my first book, I was asked to go out a lot, and I'd see these other authors, real authors, I call them, reading their books to an audience, and I thought, I don't even read my notes to the classes. I just tell them stories, and I started telling
and
stories.
That's how you became the raconteur of record.
I brought my guitar. And I started bringing my guitar, and pretty soon I was making $25 a night. Then it went to $100. Then it went to $200.
Steak for dinner.
It eventually went to $1,500 a night.
Marshall Trimble, what a gift! I'll look forward to having you back, sir.
It's good to be here.
Thank you.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.